This episode features discussion of kidnapping that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. 49-year-old Ginny Piper stumbled forward through the tall, wet grass, trailing behind one of her kidnappers.
Cold and nervous, she shivered as she climbed the gentle hill in her flimsy summer sandals. She wished she was wearing something warmer than her gardening clothes.
The light rain started to seep through the pillowcase that had been over her head for hours, and she could tell that it was starting to get darker. She could smell pine trees, the way their bark smells musty in the rain. They must be in the middle of a thick forest, hours from her home outside Minneapolis.
Ginny stumbled, and her kidnapper snapped at her to keep moving. He and his partner hadn't been violent yet, but she didn't want to give them a reason to use their guns. She got to her feet and kept going.
But soon, they stopped again. Ginny strained her ears, confused. Then she heard her captor rustling a bag. She prayed he wasn't unbagging a gun. The man ordered Ginny to sit down.
She sank onto the damp grass, soggy pillowcase sticking to her face, making it hard to breathe. She tried to take in the sounds of the forest around her, wondering if she would hear the gunshot before everything went dark.
This is Hostage on the Parcast Network. I'm Carter Roy. Every Thursday, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
And I'm Irma Blanco. We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and what the human brain does when held captive.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help us. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
This is our final episode on the kidnapping of 49-year-old socialite Virginia Piper, who was taken from her home at gunpoint just outside Minneapolis, Minnesota, on July 27, 1972.
In the ensuing 48 hours, her family and the FBI frantically tried to follow the kidnapper's demands, hoping against hope that Ginny would survive.
Last week, we followed Virginia Piper and her husband Bobby through the dramatic events of her kidnapping and the initial FBI response.
This week, we'll track how Bobby Piper and the FBI worked to satisfy the detailed ransom demands as Ginny attempted to survive her unique kidnapping. We'll also delve into how this became one of the most unusual kidnappings in U.S. history.
Around 1 p.m. on July 27, 1972, Ginny Piper's mundane Thursday became anything but. Within moments, she went from friendly, unassuming housewife to kidnapping victim, taken from her home at gunpoint by masked men.
Her husband, Bobby Piper, CEO of Minneapolis investment firm Piper, Jaffrey & Hopwood, commonly known as Piper Jaffrey, raced home to find a terrifyingly detailed ransom note. His wife was being held for the largest ransom at that point in U.S. history, $1 million. Adjusted for inflation, that would be over $6 million in 2019.
Bobby swore to do everything the kidnappers asked in order to get his wife back alive, but the FBI, the de facto kidnapping experts in the U.S. at the time, wasn't so sure. Convinced that they were dealing with hardened criminals who'd strike again if they got away with it, the FBI agents considered catching the kidnappers as important as rescuing Ginny, and the best way to catch them wasn't necessarily by complying with their demands.
As the FBI and the Piper family tried to come up with a mutually agreeable plan, and as Bobby frantically tried to cobble together $1 million from friends and family, news of the kidnapping was broadcast across the country. But nowhere did the news hit harder than the Twin Cities. locals describe the experience as akin to the news of the JFK assassination. They remember exactly where they were when they heard the alerts. Their own Ginny Piper was taken hostage.
And at the same time, several hours away, Ginny Piper herself was stumbling through the Minnesota woods with one of her kidnappers. She was cold, nervous, and unsure if she'd ever see her family again. When Ginny's kidnapper told her to sit down, she found herself settling onto a plastic sheet. As it turned out, he'd spread it across the ground to keep her from having to sit in the mud and grass.
A little later, as she sat there shivering from the cold and rain, the pillowcase still over her head, the man took off her handcuffs and gave her a large sweatshirt and a pair of men's pants to put on over her own t-shirt and cotton slacks. Even though he handcuffed her again, she was grateful for the extra layers.
Ginny realized that her first instinct about the men had been right. They weren't looking to hurt her. In fact, if this man was thinking about her comfort, it meant that at least he was hoping they'd get the ransom and be able to release her without any harm coming to her.
Then the man took the pillowcase off her head. She blinked against the light, her eyes adjusting, and breathed fresh air for the first time in hours.
But she barely had a chance to see anything before he put a blindfold over her eyes. Made of tape and cotton balls, it wasn't very effective, but it clearly made the man feel better that she was less able to see him.
Indeed, he warned her not to look at him, and Ginny made a point of trying not to. Clearly on edge, the man stressed that he'd be sitting there right behind her, and she'd better not try anything funny. She had no intention of disobeying.
Ginny was a natural people person, which inadvertently gave her an advantage as a hostage. Her congenial nature made it easy for the kidnappers to work with her, but confident she wouldn't push boundaries.
Retired NYPD Detective Sergeant and negotiator Wallace Zines advises people who are taken hostage to remain calm and avoid being either proactive or aggressive. He suggests keeping the kidnappers' emotions in mind. They too are nervous and on edge, and are more likely to overreact if the hostage pushes back or acts out.
So Ginny sat there with one of her kidnappers and waited. Now that she was pretty sure he didn't want to hurt her, she could relax. She was sure Bobby would be working with law enforcement to find her and get her back. All she had to do was wait and hope no one made a rash mistake.
In fact, she thought how lucky it was that she was the one who'd been kidnapped instead of Bobby. Despite being a generally even-tempered man, her husband was stubborn and would have resisted the kidnapper's instructions. If he'd caused trouble, she figured, they probably would have killed him by now.
Meanwhile, back at their house in Orono, Bobby was strategizing with the FBI and police. And he was being just as stubborn as Ginny suspected. However, Bobby agreed to hold a televised press conference to get the word out. They needed the public's help to keep an eye out for Ginny.
The ransom note said the kidnappers would be in touch by 9:30 p.m. on the 28th, the following evening, with instructions for delivering the $1 million ransom. And the FBI wanted to spend the time until then trying to find Ginny and her kidnappers.
Bobby wasn't used to being on TV or having to talk about his family in public. The only public speaking he did was at board meetings, which was a far cry from the national news.
When he stood in front of the TV cameras, his nerves showed. He looked pale and simply said, quote, "Obviously, there's been a kidnapping, and the case is in the charge of the FBI, and there's really nothing more I can tell you now," end quote.
He answered a few questions. Yes, there was a ransom note. No, he wouldn't tell them how much the ransom was, but refused to say much more, pointing out that he didn't want to take any chances with his wife's safety. He just wanted to make sure that everyone in the Twin Cities area was on the lookout for the kidnappers and his wife.
And he wanted the kidnappers to know, if they were watching, that he was taking their demands very seriously.
After the press conference, Bobby, law enforcement, and the extended Piper family continued their preparations. While the FBI monitored the house phone line and all the lines at Piper Jaffray, Bobby got in touch with his friend George Dixon, the president of Minneapolis's First National Bank.
Contrary to what the kidnappers clearly thought, Bobby didn't have $1 million. Piper Jaffray maybe had clients with that kind of money, but the Piper family wasn't that kind of wealthy. Instead, Bobby asked George Dixon if he could borrow the money from the bank. Dixon, a good friend, agreed without question, knowing Bobby would pay him back, one way or another.
The two men went through the ransom note's demands for how to prepare the money, and the FBI went to work recording every bill's serial number on microfilm for future tracing. Dixon promised Bobby that the money would be ready for him before the kidnappers got in touch the next day, the 28th.
All Bobby could do now was go home. He hoped the FBI's roadblocks and helicopter surveillance would find something, or that someone would call in a useful tip. He waited up with his sons and in-laws, feeling utterly helpless.
Meanwhile, Ginny sat on the forest floor as the heavy rain pelted her back. Night was setting in, and she found herself shivering with cold, even despite the extra layers. She wondered how long she'd have to wait. The large man next to her shivered miserably, and she couldn't help but feel sorry for him. He'd clearly drawn the short straw for this job. At least they were in this miserable hell together.
The blindfold had fallen off her face, and neither of them had made any moves to fix it. They both had to adjust their sitting positions a number of times, trying to stay comfortable on the ground. After all, neither of them was young, and sitting on the forest floor left them stiff and uncomfortable.
As Ginny started to realize that her captor might not especially want to be there either, she thought she might have an in. She didn't dare turn to look at him. He kept reminding her not to. But she ventured a few casual questions, hoping to engage him in conversation and find out more about the kidnappers and their plans.
According to experts on hostage situations, this was the right move. Former U.S. Marine and security consultant Kelly McCann advises hostages to try to connect with their kidnappers, both to get more information about their plans for you and in order for them to see you as a person rather than a means to an end.
At first, Ginny's kidnapper didn't want to chat, responding to her questions monosyllabically and without elaborating. But she was proud of her ability to talk to anyone, and as the night wore on, she started to get him to relax. The pair were bonding.
At one point, the man tried to make Ginny a poncho out of plastic to keep off the worst of the rain. It only sort of worked, although Ginny appreciated the effort.
After a while, the man made it clear that she should try to sleep, and they returned to silence. But she could still hear him moving around, cold and uncomfortable. Ginny didn't want to lie down on the ground, but she let her eyes close for just a moment.
And then, in the middle of the night, the man unexpectedly stood up and announced he was going to leave for a few minutes. He pulled a chain out of his bag, threaded it through her handcuffs, and padlocked her to the tree next to them.
And then he walked away into the darkness.
For the first time in hours, Ginny started to get scared. It was dark and the ground was slippery. As the minutes ticked by and the woods stayed quiet, she began to worry. Had he abandoned her? Had he slipped or gotten hurt? If she was left alone out here, she knew she'd never be found.
Next, Ginny survives in the woods alone, as Bobby finally hears from the kidnappers.
Now, back to the story.
On the rainy night of July 27, 1972, 49-year-old Ginny Piper sat chained to a tree in the Minnesota woods. Since she was kidnapped from her house at 1 p.m. that afternoon, she'd been guarded by at least one of her kidnappers. But now, when the man who'd been sitting with her in the woods for hours walked away, she worried that her captors had finally decided she was more trouble than her ransom was worth. Were they really going to leave her to the cold and wild animals?
As it turned out, she needn't have worried. The man returned a bit later, she had no idea how long, and unchained her from the tree. Ginny breathed a sigh of relief as they settled back onto their plastic tarp.
With the cover of darkness, she managed to bring herself to ask where he'd been.
"Just looking around," he replied.
They both tried to get to sleep after that, but neither could get comfortable. Finally, Ginny gave up and asked the man what time it was. 5 in the morning on Friday, July 28th.
Having made it through the night in the woods together, Ginny and her captor were more relaxed around one another, and the man finally started to open up to Ginny's questions.
As she asked about their plan and her own kidnapping, she was surprised to get actual answers.
The man, who told her that his friends sometimes call him Alabama, said that the original plan had been to kidnap her husband, Bobby, and that he didn't at all like having her involved. In fact, he was really just a cog in the plan. A man who owned a bar in Minneapolis had masterminded the whole thing and provided them with the guns and masks.
Alabama claimed he didn't even know how much the ransom was for. The only reason he was involved, he told her, was that he owed the bar owner $12,000, a debt the man had promised to forgive in exchange for helping with the kidnapping.
The plan had been to take Bobby to an apartment in a rough part of North Minneapolis while they waited for the ransom money to be delivered, which would have been much more comfortable than the woods. But once they kidnapped Ginny instead, they decided it would be too conspicuous to bring a woman there, so they changed course.
Interestingly, Alabama also implied that he didn't have any kind of criminal record, though he did mention both the Anoka State Hospital for the Mentally Ill and the penitentiary in St. Cloud, prompting Ginny to wonder if he had spent time in either.
Alabama said he was a construction worker who'd been briefly unemployed due to a strike, but he expected to be back at work on Monday. He told her more, including that he was interested in criminal psychology and would like to go to school to study it further.
Over the course of the day, he revealed other things about himself. He said he wasn't married and had no kids. Ginny opted not to press further in case it might be a sore subject. He complained about the arthritis in his knees, exacerbated by the damp weather, and told her he'd had trouble in the past with drugs and alcohol. As for his hobbies, he liked deer hunting and watching basketball.
Ginny committed everything he said to memory. She had no idea what pieces of information might be useful later.
She also found herself dissecting the man's words, looking for hidden clues about what might motivate him to assist in a kidnapping.
Alabama seemed equally curious about the Pipers and their lives, asking Ginny why they didn't have full-time staff for their house and, as he put it, quote, all those things that rich people have. Ginny replied that the Pipers didn't want or need them. She wasn't quite what he'd expected.
He clearly knew something about Bobby's work, though not enough to grasp what he actually did. He asked Ginny what the price of stock was, and she found herself struggling to explain the stock market.
Then Alabama complimented Ginny on being such a good sport about the whole kidnapping. He tried to reassure her that nothing would happen to her and that she'd get home just fine. Apparently, the plan had been for him to just leave her in the woods until they got the ransom money and told Bobby where to find her. But he hadn't felt right about leaving her on her own, so he decided to stay.
Out of nowhere, the man produced part of a loaf of bread, a few slices of American cheese, and a can of 7-Up. A starving Ginny was surprised to see the food and wondered if it had been with them the whole time.
Ginny inhaled the damp piece of bread with a piece of cheese and asked Alabama if he wanted some, but he declined. Then he pulled out a half-empty packet of cigarettes and offered her one.
Thrilled to have a smoke, Ginny didn't even mind that the cigarettes were a little damp.
When Alabama handed her the cigarette, she accidentally caught a glimpse of him. Ginny looked away, hoping he hadn't noticed.
The man was wearing some sort of mask on his head, though not the same one as when he and his partner had kidnapped her the day before. This one looked more like a woman's stocking, and it had a run in it that revealed a tanned complexion, graying dark hair, and sideburns. The only really identifiable mark she noticed was an imperfection in the side of his left eye, a sort of grayish streak outside the pupil.
She figured he was in his late 30s or early 40s, at least 6 feet tall, with a heavy build, and likely either white or Native American.
In between conversations and snacks, Alabama would chain her to the tree again and go off for a while, returning some time later. Ginny presumed he went to have a bite to eat, or to pee, or maybe even check in with his partner.
Every time he went away, she feared he wouldn't come back. Being chained to the tree scared her. It left her vulnerable to the elements and any wild animals that might happen to pass by. It meant that if he didn't come back, she would starve.
Every time he returned, she breathed a little sigh of relief.
As the hours stretched on and what gray daylight there was started to disappear, the rain picked up again. Alabama had been gone for a while after tightening the chain and handcuffs. In fact, as night set in, Ginny realized that this was the longest stretch he'd been gone for. He'd finally left her.
She was alone in the dark and pouring rain, somewhere in the middle of the forest.
How is Bobby ever going to find her?
Around the same time, in Minneapolis, Bobby, their sons, and a handful of FBI agents were sitting by the phone in the Piper's house in Orono, anxiously awaiting the kidnapper's promised call.
They'd spent the last several hours finalizing preparations for the ransom delivery, and every step of the way, the FBI agents had been arguing with Bobby, trying to convince him to do it their way.
But their way meant going against the kidnapper's instructions, which Bobby wouldn't consider. The ransom note had been clear that any deviation would put Ginny at risk.
The FBI wanted one of their agents to deliver the ransom to maximize their chances of catching whoever came to collect it. Bobby nixed that, pointing out that the note said the person delivering the ransom had to be closely associated with Piper Jaffray. And of everyone associated with the firm, he felt it was only fair that he be the one to drive the car.
The FBI then suggested they have an agent hiding in the trunk with the money. Again, Bobby refused. He wouldn't let them tail him either.
The agents begged him to at least let them put a radio transmitter in the car. This he conceded to, as long as it was well hidden. He also agreed to a small video camera in the car's grill.
In the meantime, Bobby's friend George Dixon at the bank had the $1 million in ransom money prepared. The kidnapper's instructions were followed to the letter. When the brown canvas bag was ready to go, it weighed more than 100 pounds.
Four FBI agents picked up the bag of money and drove it to Orono to await the kidnapper's call. Instead of going to the Piper's house, though, they went to the next-door neighbors, where Bobby's Oldsmobile 98 had been moved, so the throng of reporters and onlookers wouldn't notice it.
Everything was in place. In the Piper's house, Bobby, his sons, and the FBI agents waited anxiously by the phone for the kidnapper's call.
At 9:36 p.m., the phone rang.
Bobby jumped up and grabbed it.
Ginny's voice was on the line. Bobby?
He started to talk, but she kept going, telling him that the men were nice and had been taking good care of her and that he had to follow their instructions.
He tried to interrupt her, to ask her if she could hear him, but she kept going. She told him exactly what to do, giving him explicit directions for how to get to an intersection at Louisiana and Laurel. At the base of the signpost there would be something for him to pick up.
Frantically, Bobby kept trying to get her to respond to him. It wasn't until she repeated the instructions again that he realized it was a recording.
At the end of the recording, Bobby slammed the phone down in frustration. The irritated FBI agents had asked him not to hang up so they could try to trace the call, but he hadn't been thinking. Too late.
Bobby's only consolation was that, even though Ginny had clearly been repeating what she'd been told, she sounded calm and composed. She didn't seem scared or injured. She sounded just like herself, reassuring him and the boys that she'd be fine, that everything would be okay as long as he followed the instructions.
But now, the clock was running. Bobby had to get moving.
He slipped out the back door and walked over to the neighbor's house. The FBI agent showed him the money in the trunk and the radio transmitter under a blanket in the back seat.
It took him about 10 minutes to get to his destination, an intersection in a deserted industrial part of town.
He parked his car at the signpost and got out.
Then he saw it. In the weeds at the base of the post was a small white envelope. The typed all-caps instructions demanded he stay absolutely silent and follow the directions enclosed.
Opening the envelope, he pulled out a small mechanical device and a typed letter. According to the letter, the device was a radio transmitter that would allow the kidnappers to monitor him throughout the rest of the drop. He was to put it on his dashboard, antenna out.
Then, it told him to drive to a nearby shopping center. In a specific parking lot, he'd find a car with two strips of tape on the rear window and keys waiting for him. He'd put the money in the trunk of this car, bring the transmitter and his own keys, then drive across the street to a motel parking lot. Once there, he could check the glove box for his next set of instructions.
The note ended ominously, quote, "Every movement you make at this stage is being constantly observed," end quote.
Bobby glanced around, but saw no one. All he could do was keep following the instructions.
At the shopping center parking lot, Bobby found a green two-door Monte Carlo with two strips of tape across the back window, keys waiting for him. Presumably, this was the same car used to kidnap Ginny. Bobby lugged the bag of cash to the Monte Carlo, drove across the street, and checked the glove compartment. Sure enough, there was another note.
This one told him to drive about 5 miles to a power pole, where he'd find another note with his next set of instructions. The letter finished with, quote, "Travel time has been carefully checked, and you must move prudently but quickly," end quote.
As he pulled out of the parking lot, Bobby realized that the FBI's transmitter and camera were in his own car, left in the shopping center parking lot. The kidnappers, watching his every move, could easily be planning to ambush him at his next stop, and no one would have any idea where to find him.
He was truly on his own and completely exposed.
At the same moment, somewhere in the rainy, pitch-black woods, Ginny was chained to a tree, thinking the exact same thing. Next, we'll follow Ginny's desperate bid for survival as Bobby runs into trouble.
Now, back to the story.
On the night of July 28, 1972, 54-year-old Bobby Piper was trying to stay focused as adrenaline raced through his body. He was following the latest set of his wife's kidnapper's driving instructions, which took him first along a dark, wooded parkway, and then through a rough, derelict neighborhood on the edges of downtown Minneapolis. Not only were these areas he didn't know and wouldn't normally be in late at night, but they would be perfect for an ambush.
Finally, he spotted the power pole mentioned in the note and the two envelopes placed at its base.
One of them had typed instructions on the outside, telling him to read and follow these instructions first before opening the second envelope. There was also a phone number typed on the first envelope.
The first set of instructions directed Bobby to a bar called the Sportsman. The note told him exactly where and how to park, as close as possible to and facing the building.
Just like the ransom note, the instructions were methodical and detailed. The kidnappers had thought of everything.
He'd entered the Sportsman through its back door, taking the car keys and both envelopes inside with him. He was to go straight to the public payphones and dial a specific number. The note explained that the number was for another payphone, and so it wouldn't be answered. If someone did pick up, he should hang up and try again. Once he'd been able to get through and let the phone ring 5 times, he should hang up and go to the men's room. Only after he'd put the car's trunk key on the casing above the bathroom door should he read the instructions in the second envelope.
Glancing around again to see if anyone was watching him, Bobby got back in the car and drove the few blocks to the Sportsman, parking by the back door as instructed.
As he got out of the car and locked it, he scanned the parking lot. There were a handful of parked cars, but no people that he could see. It made him nervous to leave the money there, but he had no choice.
This wasn't the kind of bar Bobby ever hung out at. It was a working-class dive bar, noisy and thick with cigarette smoke. He made his way to the payphone, trying to blend in.
He dialed the number and got a busy signal.
A minute later, he tried again, still busy.
Anxiously, he looked around, but no one seemed to be watching him. What would happen if he wasn't able to get through?
He tried the number for the third time and again got a busy signal.
Trying to suppress his rising sense of panic, he picked up the phone a fourth time. This time, there was a woman on the line. She asked him not to use the phone as she was trying to make a call.
Bobby's panic started to take over. He went outside to check on the car, worried about the money. If someone stole it out of the trunk and he couldn't complete the delivery, well, he didn't think the kidnappers would be sympathetic. And if they thought he'd screwed with them, they might take it out on Ginny.
About to open the trunk just to check, it occurred to him that if someone saw the bag when he opened the trunk, that might cause trouble too. He didn't see anyone else in the lot, but he was becoming increasingly paranoid.
The only thing left to do was to try the call again, one more time. So he went back inside.
This time, the call went through. With each ring, Bobby held his breath, hoping no one would pick up.
After five rings, he could have cried with relief. He hung up and hurried into the men's restroom. A man walked out as he walked in, but otherwise the bathroom was empty. He put the trunk key above the door, then ripped open the second letter.
This note's instructions were to make the call again letting it ring five times, indicating his departure from the Sportsman. Then he was to follow another set of driving directions to a store's parking lot about 20 minutes away in the suburban town of Bloomington. The note stressed that his arrival and activities in the parking lot would be watched. He was to lock the car, go into the store, and call a cab to take him home from the store's public payphone.
This note signed off with the assurance that, if all instructions had been followed to the letter, the pickup would be made right away.
Relieved, with the end in sight, Bobby hurried out of the bar and started to pull out of the parking lot before remembering that he was supposed to call again before leaving.
Frantic, he hoped he hadn't just messed everything up. He parked the car again, ran back inside, and called the same number.
Unexpectedly, someone picked up. Bobby hung up quickly, confused. He wasn't sure if he was supposed to wait around and try again, but if someone else was now waiting for a call on that line, he'd be waiting for a while. The instructions had told him to move quickly, and he was eager to get things wrapped up. So he decided it was better not to wait around and headed back out to the car.
By the time he pulled into the store's parking lot, it was around 11:30 p.m., nearly 2 hours since he set off to deliver the ransom. When the cab came, he had the driver take him to the Wayzata Tavern near his house so he could avoid the press. There, he called his house and told the FBI agent in charge where he'd been instructed to leave the car.
Then he called a friend to come pick him up. When the friend arrived, though, they decided to drive back to Bloomington. Still concerned about making sure the money reached the kidnappers, Bobby had started to fear that someone else might try to steal the car or the money out of the trunk.
When they arrived, they saw the car still parked exactly as he'd left it. But they weren't the only ones there. Within moments, an FBI agent pulled up next to them and asked them to go home.
Bobby had done everything he could, but he worried that the kidnappers wouldn't hold up their end of the bargain and return Ginny safely.
Around the same time, Ginny was fighting her own rising sense of panic. She was alone in the woods, in the rain, in the middle of the night.
Out of nowhere, she heard a car horn. Through the trees, she saw beams of light that she assumed were headlights.
After a few moments, a man appeared in the darkness, wearing a stocking on his head, just like Alabama had been.
The man demanded to know where Tom was.
Assuming that Tom was Alabama, Jenny told the man he'd left a couple hours ago.
The man disappeared, only to return sometime later. Convinced this was her last shot at survival, Jenny told him they'd promised to take her home tomorrow morning. The man reassured her that someone would pick her up tomorrow morning at 6.
And then he disappeared again. Shortly thereafter, a man called out, "So long, Grandma."
And then the forest returned to its dark, rainy quiet. Jenny was alone again.
Exhausted, hungry, cold, and scared, Jenny decided that she didn't believe them. If they'd gotten their money, they wouldn't care what happened to her. And if they hadn't, well, then leaving her to die in the middle of nowhere was easier than killing her.
In fact, all she could think about now was her own death. She would starve, no doubt, chained to this tree. And months from now, hikers would find her body, wasted away.
In this dark moment, she began hallucinating. She heard her late mother's voice, calming her down, telling her she could get out of this. She slowed her breathing until her wits were about her.
Then she reevaluated her surroundings and realized that the tree she'd been chained to was relatively skinny and small, only about 5 inches thick, which means, she thought, that it must not have a big root system. If she were able to loosen the roots, then perhaps she could knock the tree over and free herself. Or, worst case scenario, drag the tree with her and walk closer to the road, where someone might hear her scream for help.
And so she started to desperately dig with her hands.
The night stretched on, and daylight eventually broke over another gray, rainy day. Jenny's nails were torn and caked with dirt. The handcuffs chafed on her wrists, and she tried not to think about what would happen if this didn't work.
At around 7:30 a.m., the FBI agents watching the green Monte Carlo decided they'd waited long enough. No one had come for the car or its contents in the time they'd been waiting, so it was time to pop the trunk and see whether they'd find the money or something worse.
But the trunk was empty. The money was gone. Sometime during the night, either while Bobby was in the sportsman bar or before he was able to call the FBI, the kidnappers had picked up the money.
But the FBI agents also breathed a sigh of relief. They'd been expecting to find Jenny's body in the trunk. For the first time, they started to hope that maybe she was still alive.
At around 9 a.m., a reverend named Kenneth Hendrickson in Golden Valley, Minnesota, got an unexpected call. The man on the other line asked if he'd heard about Jenny Piper's kidnapping, which Hendrickson had. It had been all over the news, including the fact that Bobby Piper had paid the $1 million ransom.
The man on the phone told Hendrickson that he'd picked his name at random from the phone book, because he wouldn't have a recording device, and that he was going to tell Hendrickson where to find Mrs. Piper. Hendrickson memorized the man's specific driving directions and then, upon hanging up, called the FBI.
Without informing the Piper family, the FBI sent 7 agents to follow the directions passed along by Hendrickson. The directions had them driving south from the northeastern city of Duluth, a couple of hours from Minneapolis. When they reached the point where they were told to turn off the highway, they realized they were turning into the semi-wild Jay Cook State Park.
They got out of their cars and started to hike through the grass into the park.
Jenny, still digging at the tree, heard their voices at a distance. She had no idea who was there, but hoped they'd been sent to help her.
She frantically called to them. In response, an unfamiliar voice replied, "Mrs. Piper, it's the FBI."
When they emerged through the forest, she sank to the ground and sobbed.
Jenny's return home was as big an event as the rest of the affair. She and Bobby spent the following months giving interview after interview to the FBI agents working the case and press conferences to an enraptured public.
The FBI tried to keep an eye out for the money from the ransom. After all the Bill's serial numbers had been recorded. But the kidnappers didn't seem to be spending it. Either that, or they were very good at laundering it through casinos.
A couple years later, a middle-aged man matching the physical description that Ginny gave of the men, wearing glasses and a beard, exchanged some of the $20 bills from the ransom at a few banks and spent some at a hardware store, but by the time the local police arrived, he was long gone.
As for Ginny and Bobby Piper, they returned to their normal life as best they could. Bobby figured out ways to pay back the $1 million over the years, and they got a guard dog. But otherwise, their life continued much as it had.
To this day, the FBI has no idea who kidnapped Virginia Piper. The money has never been recovered, and as the statute of limitations on the case ran out in July 1977, no one will ever serve jail time.
Much in the way they had taken Ginny, the two kidnappers swiped the cash, jumped in a car, and completely disappeared.
You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory. If you enjoy the podcast, leave a 5-star review while you're there. It's the best way to help us keep going.
We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by David Turk, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. Hostage is written by Kate Thorman and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.